Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Baseball Tonight. Ready to play ball? The Baseball Tonight podcast with Buster Olney gives you an insider's perspective Monday through Friday with the biggest names, stories, and analysis in the sport. Follow Baseball Tonight as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, baseball is back and so are your favorite teams and players. Catch the best of the bigs all season on ESPN Plus with over 170 live MLB games featuring every star and every team in the league. Sign up now at ESPNPlus.com/baseball. The Right Time is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about, you know, my first love breaking my heart again. Also, your story is about the worst back and forth that you've had on these social media platforms. But first, Man, every now and then I forget the Gabe went to UCLA. Every now and then I do. I was watching the NCAA tournament. I had decided that I was going to root for the University of Houston because, you know, I'm from Houston and I root for Texas and I don't really want to do that no more. So I was like, cool, I'm going to get down with U of H. They got a good historical precedent that indicates that I should be down with them. And then they got their doors blown off by Baylor. All right, great for me, right? Okay, because I really ain't never going to get down with that program, but whatever. Then the next game was Gonzaga and UCLA. Now, I have complained a lot about UCLA in this tournament because they have given us some miserably awful games to watch. Like that game where they won against Michigan, good for UCLA, bad for everybody else. What was the score, like 51-49? Keeping in mind that we got a 30-second shot clock now, not 45, and all you could put up was 50 points with somebody out here running the four corners or something. Like UCLA to me was the worst combination that you could have of a basketball team. They play slow and they don't play good defense. Like, what's the point of playing slow if you're not going to play good defense? Gabe, I'm not making this up. They're like in the lower 25 out of 350 or something like that in pace. And then they were like in the top 50 or so in defensive efficiency, according to Kent Pomeroy. That ain't enough. That ain't it. But man, that was a game. That was entertaining. It was close the whole way. It was up and down. And I felt like in the first half, where UCLA was up most of the way, they weren't up big, but they were up most of the way. I kind of had that feeling that a team like UCLA, which just isn't as good as Gonzaga is, they're going to need to stretch this lead out at some point. Otherwise, the second half, they're going to come and they're going to get swallowed. That didn't happen. Right? Then it gets down to late. Gonzaga gets the lead back. I'm like, all right, cool. Gonzaga's going to get this. No, UCLA nailed it. What was your man's name, Gabe? Was it Juzang? They hit that shot late to tie it. That dude had a hell of a tournament, man. He was rolling. I was like, oh, big shot. And then Jalen Suggs came back the other way. And did it hurt? Did it sting?
It hurt because also, too, Juzang had the opportunity at the end of regulation to get a clean look and win the game. He had that charge call on him.
Which was a charge.
Yeah, which was a charge, to be okay. Clear, yeah. But he had gotten free to the point where he could have taken like an elbow jumper
right
to try and win it, and he's a great shooter. So that hurt especially, but it was almost like more shock than pain. I was sitting there, you know, in bed, all the lights off and the TV on, just...
What can you do?
What can you do? Yeah.
What can you do? And this is the new era of basketball where that wasn't no heave. Like, he just went up and put up a jumper. Like, I don't think he was trying to put it off the glass necessarily, but that was not a lucky shot, right? Like, a lot of things have to go right. You have to be right on point in order to make it. But this wasn't like he just threw a chest pass up there and he nailed it. Like, he put it up, it hit soft off the glass, it went in. And I love where he said he always wanted to jump on the table. And now he had his opportunity to go up there and jump up the table. Like, now, was that game as good? And I understand I'm here with Gabe and Tony, and neither one of them were around for this one. But I can't begin to explain to you what an incredible game Duke-Kentucky in 1992 was. And it bore certain parallels to this game. And one interesting parallel that it bore was the idea that a perennial power could somehow be an underdog of sorts, right? Could somehow be a Cinderella. Now, it's different with Kentucky. Like, do you guys know the story of that 92 Kentucky team? All right, so the NCAA came and shut that whole thing down in the late 80s, right? They got caught, was it Chris Mills? He received a package, and when it got there, it was open, and it had some money in it, and that became a whole big thing. Eddie Sutton got run out of there, and the NCAA, who always, like, they were there to shut Kentucky down. Like, things had just got a little out of hand. It was a bit too much Wild Wild West. They shut it down. And so Kentucky's team had four walk-ons. Well, actually, I don't know if they were walk-ons. They may be going too far. But it was four guys from the state of Kentucky who came when everything was bad. And these guys were not the players that Kentucky was accustomed to getting. And so you had those four guys who were seniors, who had their jerseys raised up in the rafters at Kentucky because they mean so much to the program because they were the guys that held it down. And those four guys, and then add this dude named Jamal Mashburn. And I don't know what resonance Jamal Mashburn has with you guys, but Jamal Mashburn as a college player was that dude, right? You know, and so they go, they're playing Duke. Duke is the defending national champion. They've beaten UNLV that year. They were clearly the best team in the country. And it was one of those games with that kind of back and forth. The difference, of course, is that for the last possession, Kentucky had the lead before Christian Laettner made that incredible shot. And Christian Laettner had that incredible game where he was 10 for 10 from the floor, 10 for 10 from the free throw line. But this bore a lot of similarities because that UCLA team doesn't have that same story, right? Like, Kentucky came in as a two seed that year. Rick Pitino had just, like, magic tricked it up and got them that far. UCLA was an 11 seed that was in the play-in and then went all the way through, you know, and got there. But there was still this quality where it's like, yo, it's weird. It's UCLA. We're not supposed to think of UCLA in that way. And I refuse to think of UCLA in that way just because they are UCLA. I will not insult Gabe's alma mater by acting like they can ever be a Cinderella. It ain't that, right? They just had a year where they weren't that good, right? And they got that thing up there and they made it work. And then Gonzaga, which of course doesn't feel like a power in that sense, but still, they're undefeated. I mean, you two guys, you don't remember a year where Gonzaga didn't make the tournament. Gonzaga's made the tournament every year since I was a sophomore in college. From 99 on, they have made the tournament every single year. Like, Gonzaga's now getting those dudes, like getting the Jalen Suggs of the world. They're now getting players. Yeah, because this to them, like, this is the school that's good all the time. It's in the middle of nowhere, but a lot of things are in the middle of nowhere. A lot of schools are in the middle of nowhere, right? Like, they're getting those dudes. And so UCLA is out there. And I got to say, and Gabe, you let me know, it wasn't like the 08 UCLA team, right? It's not like you got Westbrook and Kevin Love and Darren Collison, right? Or 07, we got to follow in those dudes. But they got some players. Like, I thought, like, Juzang is a player.
Yeah, what's the thing with Juzang is he wasn't their player. Like, he was a Kentucky player and he transferred in. So that's kind of interesting in this kind of like new era of college basketball. But this UCLA team is really weird because they lost their two best players. One of them was a five-star guy who was supposed to be the point guard, and he went to the G League right before the season started. And then the other guy, Chris Smith, tore his ACL, I believe, in December.
Yeah. Now, one thing to keep in mind about, they didn't have the five star, but if there's anything UCLA is good for, it's underachieving five stars. Like, that dude might have got there and played like a three. UCLA stay getting dudes that I heard about and then be like, damn, how come you don't really be doing nothing when you play in college? And UCLA, you know what the big trick bag is for UCLA, really, in terms of like building success, not even being what they used to be, because that's impossible at this point. But the hardest thing they have is peripheral pieces. And I don't just mean players. I mean like coaches and support staff and the like. This is the thing that's happening in the NBA also with the Warriors, because it costs so much to live in the Bay that those guys who do like your research type jobs and things like that, it's harder for them to get and keep those guys because who knows where they have to live and then have to get to San Francisco in order to do whatever the stuff is that they do. And a lot of these California colleges have that same problem because it's just the money that these guys can get working in other places, and they might be living in places where they don't want, but don't nobody want to be no assistant coach living in a one-bedroom apartment, you know, which is something that can totally happen to you if you wind up being there. Like, UCLA is the only perennial power that I can think of that really has an uphill climb in that way around things that surround. Now, they find a way to get players, you know, one way or another, you know, they get dudes to come in and play, you know, but for the other stuff, it's hard for them to figure out how to do it. And I don't like your coach. I've said that before many times. I'm not much here for Cronin. I don't like the way Cronin plays basketball, and I always hold it against Cronin when them dudes that was on his team just ran past him in that Cincinnati Xavier fight that one time, and it was clear that he was terrified of his own players. Like, that's not That's not what's up. But that was a great, great, incredible game to watch. And I think it was good and necessary for this NCAA tournament to give us something to legitimately remember. I don't have anything else to remember from this tournament outside of this. But Gabe, you mentioned something, the Johnny Juzang transfer from Kentucky to UCLA, and it got me to thinking, you know, Roy Williams retired last week. And I would say to Roy, you should have done that on April 2nd instead of April 1st, because nobody really believed it when you first did it. But it seems clear to me, and Roy seemed to make it clear, like, let me act like I didn't just glean this, but Roy's big thing is, like, after this Walker Kessler dude decided that he was going to transfer, that's when Roy had just kind of had enough of this. And so the way things are evolving in terms of guys like, hey, I don't feel like this is working for me right now, right here. I am now going to transfer somewhere else. That's a complete deviation from everything that Roy Williams has ever really known. Like, the thing about Carolina is, Carolina used to tell people when they were leaving. Like, I remember in 08, Ty Lawson, Danny Green, and I think Wayne Ellington also declared early for the draft and did not sign with agents. And Roy was furious, like a fury that lasted into and through their national championship season, which didn't seem like they were actually having any fun while they were doing it. Because it was, hey, we tell you when you're ready to leave. We made the calls to the NBA, and they say now is the time for you to leave. Some guys didn't want to leave, right? Like James Worthy, Michael Jordan, those guys didn't want to leave. Marvin Williams, Brandon Wright, those are two guys who didn't want to leave, but the program told them that they were going to leave. Roy Williams is now no longer the guy who tells you that you're going to leave, right? Now, should it be that way? Probably not. But the game now for dudes is, it's not to find the best place for you to be for 4 years. It's the best place for you next year. That's the way guys look at it. But that evolution is not really about college, you know? And I don't even know how much of that is about guys necessarily trying to get to the NBA, because you look at all these guys that are transferring, however many hundreds of guys are looking to transfer this year, 60 guys drafted in the NBA every year. Like, a significant majority of these guys are never going to sniff the NBA, probably won't even go play in Europe. But these dudes have been doing this since they were freshmen in high school. Like, what you're not getting anymore, and this is like I've always thought was a big thing that happens when these guys get to the NBA, is the idea of being loyal to the team that you play for in a long-term way no longer exists. Like, it didn't really fully register with me until I lived in South Florida and started paying attention to what happens with high school football there, where those dudes go to a different school every year. And not even a place that's like close to your house. You know, they go into one school this year, another school that's an hour away next year, maybe another school the year after that. Like, every year it's hop and go to a different place. Like, and you can ascribe it partially to AAU stuff, because AAU also has you, you know, bouncing from team to team or whatever. But back in the day, it used to be that if a guy went to a zillion different schools, it was an indicator that it was a problem with that guy. Kevin Durant went to 3 or 4 high schools. You know, that's different. So as soon as a guy moves to go to play ball, that's his job now. Like, once that happens. And so what I think is happening with these guys in college is that same exact thing, that everybody's moving from school to school, place to place, because that's what they started doing years ago. Like, they don't look at it like, oh, I'm going to go to North Carolina and be part of that family and do that for 4 years. And this is where I'm going to college. They're not going to school. They're going to play ball. So at every turn, they're looking for where the best place is for them to play ball right now. The problem is, and where things are different, it used to be an understanding that, A, most cats weren't going to go to the NBA, and B, you weren't going to make that much money in the NBA anyway. Well, now the money for the NBA is so much bigger than it's ever been that the calculus on this is different, and maybe it's worth it to you to try to go find a different place for you to go to do this and, you know, bounce around and all of this stuff. Game has changed. You're going to have Johnny Juzang wind up there. You're going to have Baylor with all these guys that are transfers. You're going to have Houston with all these guys that are transfers, because these cats are looking for a new place to play every year. And it is not good for college basketball. Now, that's not to say that these players shouldn't be able to do this. I think that is a different discussion in and of itself. But for college basketball itself, no, it's not good to have these dudes hop around every year. There is something to be said for having guys that you see play on a team year after year. The guys you feel like, oh man, that seems like that dude's been in school forever, right? Like, there's a value for the overall game for having guys stay in one place. And I think there's a value for the individual players for staying in one place. Playing college basketball long-term in your life, probably not that important. That's the way that I see it. Probably not that important. but it's not going to change because now the professionalizing of these guys starts so much earlier. And the idea of positioning yourself to be a basketball player starts so much earlier. It's not going to stop when they get to college. That's not going to be it. So you're going to see a lot of these things happen. And it's not just going to be the, like, we got this one transfer and now it's on and pop. It's going to be a lot of transfers. If I'm Roy, I totally get why, if I got all my money and this isn't the game I want to play, I 100% get why it is that he would not want to keep doing that. I get it 100%. But then you look at UCLA, you see Johnny Juzang, and you say to yourself, yeah, but Roy would have took that dude if he'd have come.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, as many of you know, I grew up with the Atlanta Braves, all right? And I'm trying to keep this as quick as possible, but just for people who don't know me that well or don't understand why the Braves are a thing to me, I was born in Atlanta, and right before I turned 7, we moved to Houston. We lived in Houston from when I was 7 until I was 17. And keep in mind, this is 1987, right? There wasn't no apps to watch all the stuff. There wasn't no league pass. There were no extra innings. There wasn't anything like that. Imagine my surprise when I got to Houston, by the way, and found out that we still had Channel 17, okay? And so we moved from Atlanta, and the Houston that we moved to, at least, was much different than the world that I was accustomed to. I didn't know anything about it, but we still had the Braves. Like, the Braves are still coming on. And the best part was we were in the Central time zone now, instead of the Eastern time zone. So now when the Braves played in California, I could see the first couple of innings of the game because I couldn't. Like, that was my thing. I watched every Atlanta Braves game. I don't know if anything's ever made me happier than the 91 Braves, right? Like, all of those things. Like, I don't pay attention to them like I used to. I bailed on them a while ago for reasons that I guess will probably come up later in this. But that team meant something to me that no team has ever meant and ever will, in terms of just like an emotional raise. You guys hear the way I talk about sports, right? It's a different ball game for me with the Braves. Always was. And in 2013, the Braves moved the team to Cobb County. And to me, it was kind of offensive in a way. And the reason was they were in the city, right? Over there on the east side at Turner Field, a black neighborhood. Like, it's where Fulton County Stadium was. And they moved to Cobb County. Cobb County put up $400 million for them to go. It was supposed to be voted on. It was not. They jammed it through. The politician that made the deal work wound up getting voted out because Cobb County didn't even want them. But if you know anything about the city of Atlanta, it felt real familiar. Like, the idea that the Braves were going to pack up their stuff and cross the Lester Maddox Bridge. Look up Lester Maddox, M-A-D-D-O-X, if you're unfamiliar with him, and then go to Cobb County. And the idea was, it'll bring us closer to our fans, to which I said, kinda. Right? The stadium's closer to downtown. That's going up 75, so that's going northwest. The people that are north and east, they still have a traffic boondoggle in order to get there. Like, they had some people out there that was to the west that would probably want to get there, but they were basically saying, we're moving the team closer to the white folks because the white folks are the ones that are coming to the games. And maybe that was the case, but I felt like when the Braves were good, when I was little, like that 91 team, the Braves were really, really black. Like, when you go back and look at those teams, Terry Pendleton, Otis Nixon, Brian Hunter, Rafael Belliard, I can go up and down the names. David Justice, Lonnie Smith. Like, it was a very black team just in terms of who was there. And then you look up one day in like the 2000s and it's number white dudes, basically. It all didn't feel right. Like, it felt like they were abandoning the idea of having a broad, diverse fan base. Like, it was a hockey team. You know what I mean? Like that's not something like a hockey team would do. Like, in Miami, for example, I didn't blame this on this in Miami. When the hockey team used to play in Dade, and then they moved it out to Broward. Yeah, because the people that were going to go watch hockey were out in Broward. I didn't feel like baseball had to be that way. Like, I didn't feel like black people turned their back on baseball as much as baseball turned their backs on black people. Like, that was how it felt to me. And so this city, with this long legacy of white flight and everything else, and then this team jumps and crosses over to Lester Maddox Bridge to go play in Cobb County, even though Cobb County didn't even say they wanted them, right? And then there's another level to this that you may not know. One thing about Atlanta is public transportation is the ground for the fight at all times. Like, that's a huge thing. And all those counties, like outside of Fulton and DeKalb, they don't want public transportation because they're afraid that black people are going to come. You're like, gee, why is Atlanta's traffic so bad? Racism. That's why Atlanta's traffic is so bad, because all these white folks move all the way out. And rather than provide a mechanism that would make it easier for them to get into town without having to use all this gas and clog up the freeways, no, they fought like hell at every turn to make sure no train was coming out there, because they afraid that black people were going to come out there with them on those trains. That's the bottom line, right? This is important context for understanding what went on with the All-Star game and the Braves. All right. So the Braves were supposed to host the All-Star game this year in 2021. And they had planned, after Hank Aaron died, to do a big Hank Aaron tribute and all of that stuff for the All-Star game. Major League Baseball pulled the All-Star game because of this voting bill that was just passed in the state of Georgia. Okay. I am going to ask you to go look at the bill itself and draw your own conclusion, right? I don't want to sell you on the bill in one direction or another, but I'm just going to say to the people who say the bill actually increases access to voting, when has the Republican Party in the United States ever tried to do that? Like, when's the last time the Republican Party or whatever the right-wing party of the day was, when's the last time that they did that? Like, the strategy for them, and I'm not offering you some interpretation, this is fact and we've seen it across the board. The strategy for them when it comes to voting is, we got a better chance the fewer people vote. So these people who push this through are not going to be people to expand the franchise, because the brand is to not expand the franchise. You can go find all kinds of quotes from all kinds of people about these things. In North Carolina, when they passed this bill, it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said that that bill used, quote, surgical precision, unquote, to discriminate against black people voting. Like, that was the point. So even if you decide to use semantics to go through that bill and decide that it's not going to restrict people's voting rights, ask yourself why it is, after the GOP lost two Senate seats and the presidential electoral votes that year, why would they want to change the rules? If you really believe it's to make it easier for people in general and black people specifically to vote, you're a goddamn fool. That's just not what they do, period. There's no way around that. And so the money is out on this, right? A lot of these companies that are doing work in Atlanta, no, man, they were out on this. Microsoft, they're building something new in Southwest Atlanta. They out. Coca-Cola, local, they said they was out. Delta tried to say they tried to help them do something better than this, but they're out. The money said they were out. And our guy, Howard Bryan, said he made his calls and it was clear. The money told Rob Manfred, nah, dog, we ain't doing this. And so baseball said, we're not doing it either. The governor, Brian Kemp, put out a statement that said that basically what happened is everybody fell for these far left lies and blamed Stacey Abrams for it. Stacey Abrams don't want the game to lead, right? Like, if they was really about that, you go call Stacey Abrams and be like, well, how can we get together to try to keep this game? That wasn't what it was, but Stacey Abrams, who ran for governor a couple of years ago and did not win, a brilliant woman, a black woman who basically built the voting infrastructure that helped organize all the people to turn Georgia blue in 2020. If you go read Brian Kemp's statement, it's abundantly clear what's going on. If you see all the dog whistles they're blowing and all the fingers they're pointing, who they're blaming and everything, like, it's clear. And whenever they say far left, I'm like, dog, let me tell you something. I know some far left people. It ain't the ones that you're talking about. But anyway, that's what the Braves did, right? After this game was moved, the Braves, rather than saying, we hate that this is happening, we'd like to have the game here. No, the Braves just came out and went full victim on it, right? And the Braves were like, the victims of this are the fans, the business owners, and everybody else that would have gotten this money if we were going to have the All-Star game here. Nah, man, let me tell you something about Atlanta, man. Maybe you could talk about the business owners, you know, kind of, sort of. But the quote-unquote people, wasn't none of that money going to trickle down to them? And I know that because the money never trickles down to the people in Atlanta. That is something, by the way, for which white people and black people are responsible, right? The black political class in Atlanta has always been able to maintain its power because of its allegiance to the business interests of the city. That's how it's been the case. As black power in Atlanta is moderate power. And black power in Atlanta has overseen a level of income inequality that is in line with the developing world. Like, you go look that stuff up and you go to the worst of Atlanta and baby, it is bad. Like, you got, you know, that black mega stuff, there's something to it, right? It's a whole lot of black people making a whole lot of money. And it's a lot more black people struggling like hell out here. And if you think that damn All-Star game is going to make any money for those people, that wasn't going to happen. That wasn't the deal. All right. MLB had no choice here. The money said, we not doing this. they weren't going to do this. The Braves had the nerve to put out a statement that said that they were hoping to use the All-Star game as a platform for discussion about voting rights. Gay, we do this, you know, with like a Zoom type platform. You know what I mean? I need you to help me out. Do you see sucker written across my forehead?
No.
I'm just checking because they apparently think I'm a sucker. Right? Like they was going to go out there and before the home run derby, we would like to have a debate on voting rights. That wasn't never going to happen. That wasn't never their plan. And baseball, I think, knew this. There would have been some discourse and discussion around that game around voting rights. It would have been outside the stadium. It would have been people holding up signs. Like there would have been some drama surrounding this if it had been that. Nah, dog. Couldn't be. But the Braves, and where they broke my heart on this was, they didn't have to lash out at anybody, all right? They could have got in line with the league and just been like, hey, this is a decision that the commissioner's decided that he is going to make. While we do not agree with it, you know, so forth and so on. No, no, no. What the Braves did was say to the white people, we're on your side. That's what the Braves chose to say in that moment, right? They're worried about the business owners. You worried about the people they're making it harder to vote for? Like, you worried about them? Nah, they weren't worried about them. But just as they did when they took their happy asses up 75 and went to Cobb County, they did it for the white folks. They moved that team out there for the white folks. And then they came out here and said what they had to say for the white folks. That is their audience. There is no principle around this. There is no notion of fairness or anything else. They did this. And the way that they took it after the fact was to make sure the white people knew that they were not on board for all this soft wokeness or anything else. That was the most important thing for them to let the world know after they lost that All-Star game. And yes, that is heartbreaking. Now, I did Sarah Spain's radio show the other day with Jason Fitz, Spain and Fitz. And Sarah made the point, she was right, you know, that the Braves put out this statement and it also has the tomahawk on it. You know, and they're like, oh, yeah, racial tolerance. This ain't about that, though. That's a separate issue. That's a completely separate issue. This isn't about some broad, like, racial intolerance or like a broad, like it is, I guess, about a broad white supremacy. You can make that argument. This is about black people. This voting thing is about black people. These statements are speaking to white people about black people. This is about something very specific that has gone on in this city for a long time. The Braves put in their statement that the city has been a uniter. The city has always been divided. The city has been segregated in a way that is actually, I wouldn't say terribly uncommon for a lot of places, but fairly, right? There's a number. What's it take for white people to think a neighborhood is a black neighborhood and the trip over is 30%? Then when a black neighborhood turns 30% black, shortly thereafter, it'll be 100% black because 30% is enough to make white people think they've lost everything. They weren't waiting for 30 in Atlanta. As soon as one black family was moving in the 60s, all gone. Like Hank Aaron did not want to live in Atlanta. In 1964, he was thinking about moving to Atlanta before the Braves actually moved there. He was thinking about living in Atlanta and he didn't want to because of the segregation. Like he'd been in Milwaukee, which is like residentially segregated now, but was not like explicitly segregated in the 60s. He didn't want to come to Atlanta. So Hank Aaron's crib over off of Adams Drive across the street from the dungeon, the legendary dungeon from Organized Noise Production, Outkast and them. I think the Braves got to Atlanta in 66. Them neighborhoods over there were white until like one black person rolled up. Then they's all black. Like it didn't take no time at all for them to turn all black right then when they got there. That's what it was. That's what this city has always been. And as much as they want to say this city has been a uniter, did that statement look like it was uniting anything? No, it didn't. That statement was a baseball team that has decided who matters. They're not trying to make as much money as they can. They trying to stick with the white people that they feel like matter. And nobody else does as far as they are concerned. And it was pathetic and it was saddening for me to see. So, hey man, I don't really care where the All-Star game is played. I'm guessing they're going to wind up doing it in Milwaukee because it allows them to do the Hank Aaron tribute still. Bud Selig there, you know, and all of that stuff. Like I think that they'll be able to pull that off. But on a very personal level, what I saw from that team really did hurt. And I know better than that. You know what I mean? I know better than expecting things from these institutions in that way. But it was like the nail in the coffin for me for like the first thing outside of my family to really emotionally resonate with me in that way. And they about dead to me now. And it's because they decided to jump in the grave themselves.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, but money, this first story comes from tech.
Hi, my name is Reed Albergati. I am a reporter with the Washington Post, and I wrote an article about scams on Apple's App Store. A lot of people think that everything on the App Store is vetted by Apple and is therefore completely safe. But it turns out that's not quite true. Apple does look at every app before it approves them and allows them onto the App Store. But once they're approved, any app, and there's almost 2 million of them, can change and become something else entirely. And some of those apps, it's a small minority, but some of them do this and try to trick people into entering personal information that they can then use to steal money or identities, etc. And I wrote about one of these scams. There is something called a Trezor hardware wallet, and it's kind of like a USB drive that people buy in order to store their cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. So Trezor does not have an iOS app, but every once in a while, a Trezor app will pop up on the App Store or, you know, the Google Play Store on Android as well. And some people who own these hardware wallets will fall for this and download the app and enter their information that they're not supposed to enter. One of the people I talked to lost his life savings when he entered his info into this fake Trezor app. It was about $600,000 in Bitcoin. It would be worth about $1 million now. He's got no idea where it is. And what he said to me was that he was lulled into a false sense of security because he believed Apple's marketing that everything on the App Store was safe, that there were no scams. He sort of let his guard down. He was normally very careful with this kind of thing. And, you know, I thought this was just an interesting story because Apple has been using this vetting, the safety of the App Store, as kind of a defense in lawsuits and in scrutiny. Lawmakers in Washington and Europe have been accusing Apple of using their immense power in the App Store to advantage themselves and charge exorbitant commissions. And Apple says it really needs those commissions and it needs to have power over the App Store in order to keep it safe. But I think here we kind of see that, in fact, the App Store is not entirely safe. And it is a little bit more like the open internet than people like to think.
You say they lost their whole life savings to an app? I'll be trying to tell y'all about that funny money.
But it was real money to begin with that was still quite high.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm just, my point being, once you start engaging in that funny money, the problem I have with the funny money, and I get all the arguments why people want to play the games with the funny money and everything else, you just need to look at who the people are that are encouraging you to get involved in that funny money and ask yourself how likely they are to steal from you. Because I look at the people that are in on this funny money, and you know what they all have in common? Degenerate gambling. The degenerate gambling crowd, that's the straight line into the funny money. And a lot of what we've seen in the last year, people getting down with funny money, people who couldn't go to casinos in the pandemic and needed something else to roll the dice on. I'm just saying, we're coming close to the point where funny money is going to be like cocaine. And what I mean by that is, I have never used cocaine. I don't really kick it in them circles. But what people tell me, the worst thing about cocaine is the people that you meet while you are using cocaine, the circle and who all's around it. And funny money is right there in the same place. Like, I'm just telling you now, like, if this was a case of somebody putting their funny money in a wallet and then the wallet got jacked. I've been warning people about this with the funny money for like 7 years. And there have been stories about this for so long. Like, this ain't as much an app story as much as it is a funny money story about what happens when you put your stuff in these wallets with these other people. And then next thing you know, you look up and your funny money's gone.
It's also a trust story, though, with virtual tech products. Because if you think about it, you've talked about buying stuff off of Instagram.
Yes.
This is kind of like a similar thing because people trust the App Store, right? They trust App Store in the same way that people trust Instagram. Oh, Instagram wouldn't possibly dupe me on this like fly t-shirt that I want to buy. Why is it supposed to be shipping from China and it's like going to be here in like 2 months? Like, what's happening here?
Yeah, man. Watch your back.
All right, the second story also comes from tech.
My name is Jay Green, and I'm a technology reporter in Seattle for the Washington Post. I wrote recently about Amazon pushing back in unusually combative tweets against a series of claims by critics, including tweets that the company's productivity demands are so intense that workers routinely pee in bottles because they can't take restroom breaks. It all started when Dave Clark, the CEO of Amazon's worldwide consumer business, mocked Senator Bernie Sanders, who has been a vocal supporter of unionization efforts by Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama. I often say we are the Bernie Sanders of employers. Clark tweeted, but that's not quite right because we actually deliver a progressive workplace. I should note that Amazon chief executive Jeff Bezos owns my publication, The Washington Post. If the snark had stopped with the Sanders exchange, I think most people would have moved on. But the Twitter account for Amazon's PR operation continued sniping at other members of Congress. The line that got the most attention? Amazon's attack of Mark Pocan, a Wisconsin Democrat who countered Amazon's claims of being a progressive workplace with reports that workers sometimes need to pee in bottles because they are too pressed for time to run to a restroom. You don't really believe the peeing in bottles thing, do you? Amazon's PR account tweeted incredulously. Twitter lit up with reports by claims of workers, particularly drivers who work for companies that deliver packages for Amazon, that they indeed have needed to pee in bottles. And late Friday, Amazon did what to some seemed unthinkable. It apologized. The company acknowledged that its drivers, as well as those who deliver packages for other companies, often have trouble finding restrooms. And it specifically apologized to Representative Pocan. Amazon has rebutted claims it's disagreed with before, but the disdain that dripped from the recent tweets was striking, and it seemed to be driven by the barrage of news about the high-stakes Bessemer union drive. We should have a sense about the outcome of that vote in the next few days.
Hey, man, this is my thing to keep track on this, and I'm not the first person to point this out, but Amazon is becoming a bipartisan issue, right? Like, a lot of this big, massive corporate control and, like, the big tech stuff and everything else, that is slowly but surely becoming a bipartisan issue. Now, as you might imagine, I don't really do too much Republican type stuff, but like the Republican opposition to big tech, they're getting on this about the idea that they are like molding ideas or like determining what people see and do not see. And that's not nearly as simple as I think that those folks want to make it out to be, where they think there's this like discrimination or bias against conservative ideas. And I'm like, wow, that's weird, because they show wind up in my mentions from people. Conservatives do not seem to be underrepresented on Twitter at @Bomani_Jones. You know, it don't seem to be that necessarily. But hey, man, Amazon, like, I remember when Walmart was basically the Amazon of the day, and my mother's secretary, her husband's family owned a hardware store in a small town, and they were just like, look, man, Walmart can buy this stuff cheaper than we can sell it. Like, what exactly are we supposed to do? And Amazon's become that, like, on a whole bunch of different levels on this. Like, the winner for Amazon perhaps is the consumer in a lot of ways, but the loser is the worker, and the loser is the small business person. And so I think what you're going to see in a lot of these places, like stories about people peeing in bottles and stuff like this, people who were primarily inclined to like ignore those plight of the worker type things, no, I think that's going to get more gas and get more steam from both sides of the aisle. Like your man, not your man, Gabe, but Tucker Carlson, right? Even though I do think he's from your neighborhood, and I think he's from up there. You know what I'm saying?
I'm going to look this up right now. I think when you see my man.
I said he wasn't your man. Like, even after I said he wasn't your man, Gabe was like, oh, no, he ain't my man. But here's why Tucker Carlson works. Like, you could think that Tucker Carlson is effective because of just like rampant racism or whatever, but he ain't the only person who would do that. You know what I'm saying? Like, no, Carlson works because Carlson fundamentally has a point. And his point fundamentally is these corporations are ruining our lives. Now, where he goes from there is all kinds of different places that I would not go. But part of why he works is that the fundamental ethos behind what he's talking about is correct, right? It starts with corporate power and then it goes from there, which is to say a fear of corporate power is a bipartisan issue. Amazon's going to become the easiest institution for people to bring it to for that reason. Gabe, looks like you looked it up and I was right.
Well, he was born in San Francisco, but then he went to Trinity College in Connecticut.
Ah, oh, he's Gabe, y'all are like brothers.
Please don't do this to
me. I'm sorry, Gabe. I know UCLA lost.
We can play the elevator music on this.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
The first time Gabe is called for the elevator music. I like it.
This last story comes from Business.
This is Marianne Russin with BBC News Online. Last Monday, the huge mega container ship Ever Given was finally freed after being wedged in the Suez Canal for 6 days. A trapped ship might sound funny, but the numbers involved are pretty big and have had a big impact on the global shipping industry, not to mention countless businesses, manufacturers, and retailers all over the world. In my article, I explored the key figures to show the extent of the problem. For instance, the Suez Canal Authority said that it was losing $15 million in revenues per day that the blockage continued. About 12% of global trade, around 1 million barrels of oil, and roughly 8% of liquefied natural gas pass through the canal each day. And shipping journal Lloyd's List calculated that the ship had been holding up $9.6 billion of trade each day. That's a lot of numbers. In total, there were 422 ships stuck in a tailback on either side of the canal, which measures 193 kilometers long. And speaking of memes and jokes, it might interest you to know that the internet made more than 145,000 social interactions on the Twitter hashtag SuezBlocked while the situation was ongoing. Those numbers sound pretty scary as it is, but the long-term impact could be even worse. Although the ship was freed last Monday, it still took another 5 days for the 422 stranded ships to finally pass through the canal. The last of the backlog was cleared over the weekend on Saturday.
Is it just me? I did not realize just how cracking shipping still was. Like, it makes sense that there's some stuff, like you can't just put a barrel of oil on a plane, you know? But I just hadn't thought about how much shipping still matters.
Where's the port in New York, in New York City?
I would assume that it's over there, like down to the east somewhere.
Got it. Because, yeah, if you've ever lived nearby a port, you know how cracking shipping still is. Like the port of L.A., you know, the port in the Bay Area, which is right in Oakland. Good God, yeah. Man. Just huge ships coming in at all times.
Yeah. But now let's add this up and make it a world thing, right? You know, like the Suez Canal got blocked and it held up the world, basically. When that happened. Let me tell you, this also made me think of, too. Like, you remember we would read about this, like, you know, when they built the Panama Canal or when they built the Suez Canal and that was important enough to put in history books. Think of all the time that got saved when they built the canals. Like, you used to have to bring that thing all the way around Africa. Now we can just take this little shortcut. Or you used to go down all the way around South America, which sounds really cold, by the way, you know, to get that over across. Man. It was just something I hadn't given a whole lot of thought to. And then the Suez Canal got backed up. And it was like, whoa, this is a big problem. You go look at some of that stuff that was on them ships. Like, this is going to hold up the entire world. And I can't tell you how self-conscious I would feel. Like, I don't know if you've ever been on the road and your car break down in the middle of the lane or something. And you're just sitting there waiting. And you just feel like, damn, I'm holding everybody up. Now do that to the whole world in a boat.
There's no pull pass, go by me.
No, not an option. It's a one way.
No tow either. Just sitting there for days on end.
Yes, that is all.
Some of the like screenshots, overview of the canal where you've got all the little ships all clustered together. Uh-huh. How long do you think the time was before someone decided, I need to pull out the Google Maps on this one and get myself down Africa?
Yes. Well, Waze, like, why is Waze telling me to go around? I don't understand. And who's the first person to get in there and start honking a horn?
Did I accidentally select no ferries and no bridges option?
Yeah, I mean, it hit me with the shortest distance, not fastest time. No freeways. It hit me with that one.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So last week, we had that story with Durant and Rappaport. You thought it would be a good idea to put that topic out to the listeners. See what sorts of Twitter scraps we could pull from the listeners. A lot of people are really quite shy.
Yeah, like, because they don't want to admit who they are. Like, I was trying to think about, because People don't understand this about me because I had them back and forth with people. I don't really be getting heated, though. I really don't care what y'all think. Like, there's a lot of people who say that and they're being like dismissive. No. Like, honestly, I really don't care. Like, I sometimes like going back and forth, like entertaining everybody else by slamming the rest of you. I really had a hard time to think about something that really had me heated. But I might think of something as I hear these other people talk about being heated.
And usually when that Twitter beef happens, it's usually between you and a well-known figure or you and someone that you've never met. Turns out to be some sort of egg-like figure.
Yeah, like I wasn't heated that time me and Chris Broussard had a back and forth on the topic of chastity. I wasn't heated, but I think he was. He told me to apologize to him and his Lord. And I was like, yo, that's not going to happen. That's hustling backwards.
Well, the first voicemail comes from a guy who had some fighting within his own family. It's Anthony in California.
Following your girl on Twitter is not for the faint of heart. I'm not saying because she's flirting with anybody or anything like that. But once I got mad on Twitter because she posted, I wish I could have a house like this. And mind you, we just bought a house last year that, you know, we put a lot of hard work into and that I love. So I hit her up on the phone like, what the heck's wrong with our house? Why don't you like it? And it started a whole argument. I ended up sleeping in the guest room over a Twitter post about a different nice house that I would like to live in too. So, yep, I was stupid. Thanks, Bo.
Yo, I feel where he's coming from, though. Like, why are you telling people this? Like, one thing people got to stop acting like, I was just putting it on Twitter. No, you are communicating this to somebody for some reason. You know, like you could have written it in your journal or you could have just sent it to me if that's what it was. Like, what exactly it is that you sending this out for? I get why he was heated. And I bet he was still in the wrong all at once. Because he's like, yeah, I want to live in that house, too. Like, she could have said, yo, this house is dope, you know? But I just cleaned out my savings to buy this house. And you talk about how you want something else, so I got to go get another job?
And that's kind of an interesting use of Twitter, too. Wasn't it kind of like the original Twitter that was supposed to be like kind of a digital journal where you just start like writing almost as if you're writing them to yourself, like keeping record of them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
There was a social media platform that was like that. This sounds kind of more like something you want to maybe like write down for later, like on a post-it, but not really to be sharing to a big group of people.
Yeah, it would have gone over different if she had just pinned it on Pinterest.
Exactly.
Put on your vision board.
Isn't that what a pinning tab is?
Yes.
Putting that little heart next to it, saving it for later?
Yes.
All right, this next one. This guy actually had a beef with something you said. He didn't leave his name or where he was from, but I assume he's from Arkansas.
Hey, Bomani. The dumbest thing that ever got me heated on Twitter once was actually something you said when you said, don't nobody give a damn about Arkansas. It got me heated, not because you were wrong, but because you were right. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm glad you came out here and admitted it. Here's how little respect America got for Arkansas. The interstate highway system was done basically to run an interstate through everybody's major city. Just about every city that you've heard of is off of an interstate highway. Except for one, Little Rock. Like, you take 40 through Arkansas, and there will be an exit to direct you toward Little Rock. Now, I don't know. Maybe there's an up-down that go through Little Rock. I don't recall coming across it, if there was or whatever. But that's how little respect y'all got. It's unfortunate, man, for Arkansas. Like, I wasn't really trying to shade y'all, but don't nobody give a damn about Arkansas. That's the truth. Y'all ain't got no dot. I've talked about this many times. You got to worry about them states that ain't got no dots. Arkansas ain't got no dot. Now, I need to step it up and get a dot. And by the way, Arkansas is just close enough to enough other stuff that you're like, yeah, we could stay here and make a dot, or we could move to Dallas, or move to St. Louis, or move to Memphis. Hell, maybe even move to Jackson.
Well, where did the original slander from Arkansas come from?
I forget what it was that had come up. It was something directly related to Arkansas. Like, I can't remember if it was Arkansas football or something, but it was just like, look, man, you got to understand, don't nobody care about y'all and what happens to y'all. A lot of people from Arkansas were like, damn, you right. And then there was a couple that was just like, hey, don't be talking about Arkansas. And then they realized, damn, I don't want to live there no more neither.
Oh, my gosh. All right, this last guy, he also didn't leave his name or where he was from. It seems like a common occurrence here in this segment, but it was also a funny one.
So right before last year's Super Bowl, I had tweeted out, seeing Tom Brady happy during Black History Month doesn't really sit well with my spirit. Go Chiefs. I really didn't think much of it. Moved on with my day. So fast forward to the end of the game. I'm scrolling through Twitter, and all of a sudden I get 20-30 notifications. Piques my interest. I'm not popping like that. So I'm wondering what's going on. So I go and check, and my mentions are chock full of people calling me everything but my name. Folks talking about, white people are allowed to be happy during Black History Month, and, white people are the real racists. And I'm like, how did all these patriots find my tweet? So I do a little bit of research and come to find out a popular right-wing YouTube personality found my tweet and added two words, identity politics. And it was off to the races after that. I was up half the night arguing with these yahoos. In retrospect, I kind of wish I had deleted the tweet and washed my hands of the situation. But, I'd be sometimes.
Yeah, I bet the people you was arguing with wasn't even people. That's the worst part. Like, that's when I started falling back. I was like, I can't even find a real person to argue with. Like, if I really want to come out here and argue with somebody, I can't even find a real person. I'm with you. How did that other person find it? And the cutest thing about this to me, and I don't mean to patronize you, dude, but you'll understand where I'm coming from. Gabe, when I hear people talk about, I woke up and I had 30 mentions, my mentions were in shambles. I'm like, psh, I wish. I didn't get 30 mentions without sending nothing. Like, now y'all know what it's like to be me.
Yeah, but you turn off your notifications at least.
Oh, yeah, no. I could not get a vibration on my phone every time something came up. That would not. I have turned them filters all the way up, all of that stuff. Because there ain't no telling who's going to pop into my situation at any given point in time. Then I just look at it and I'd be like, oh, not a real person. Look at that. Wow. Just got on Twitter in 2020, huh? Like, all those years passed. And then you just woke up and were like, I should try this Twitter thing. Okay, I got you. Like, the class of 2020, man, they try so hard to do work. And I'm like, man, I can't even engage with y'all on this, man. I can't even play this game. But that's the thing I figured out is that I didn't realize, like, I was out here slamming people for fun, but I didn't realize how many people were making an industry out of, like, making that happen. And I felt used. And I was like, nah, man, I can't even play this game with y'all no more. I can't even do it. Hit it with identity politics. Damn.
The class of 2020.
Yeah, man, class of 2020. Class 2021 on the way, too, boy. They about to be kicking the exact same way. Damn shame. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. Do this thing three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Tony Collette, you handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Reed Albergati of The Washington Post. Check out his story about funny money and people getting got at the App Store. Thanks to Jay Green of The Washington Post. Check out his story on Amazon and the fight that they're having about workplace conditions. And thanks to Marianne Russin of the BBC. Check out her story on the cost of the blockage at the Suez Canal on the BBC. Follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.